Those of us for whom literacy is like skin have trouble imagining not reading or not writing, not knowing our sums. But those of us for whom numbers are nightmares, or who struggle to make a book or a newspaper give up its secrets, who cannot write a letter home, live in a different world. It is a world of foreign languages in familiar places, cryptic scribbles at the store, at work, in church, at home. In this nation, millions of people struggle with literacy. Millions more have given up. Over the next hour, we'll meet four people who have not given up, who came out of or are coming out of a kind of darkness into a kind of light. And we'll hear another collection of voices, people dedicated to helping others turn the lights on. To start, a roundtable discussion looking at some of the myths about literacy and some of the truths. The collection of voices we'll hear first belong to Susan Knabel from the Literacy Council and Sue Sheriff of Noel Wien Library, then Louise Charles from Tanana Chiefs Conference, Becky Morse, who heads Adult Learning Programs of Alaska, and Chris Hall of the Fairbanks Literacy Consortium and Noel Wien Library. Susan Knabel first.
There's an association made in the public's mind with illiteracy, and that is lack of intelligence or stupidity. And they do not go hand in hand. When someone is not able to read as an adult or not able to fill out the forms that they're handed, it has nothing at all to do with their intelligence.
But I think I'd be more blunt than that. I think the stereotype is that if you're illiterate, you're probably poor, you're probably not very bright, and you probably haven't tried very hard. I don't subscribe to this, but I feel very strongly when I talk to people about literacy issues, they think, oh, those are some other people, maybe even people that don't even live in Fairbanks or anywhere near my environment.
Illiterate. Someone who cannot read or write the English language. And I've seen older Native Alaskans who are described as illiterate or stereotyped as illiterate. And it may be difficult for them to communicate in English, and that means reading and writing, but they are fluent in their native tongue and probably literate as well. Mm. And that's mm-hmm. very common. And that's, true for all native languages and cultures in Alaska.
What do you think that brand does when a stereotyper does not acknowledge other fluencies?
Well, I think that it kind of turns the tables in my mind. I don't expect you to speak and understand Yupik any more than, you should expect me to. But we should also respect each other's native heritage and language and culture. And if that includes the literacy of our own language and culture, then that's a very valid point. So I think there is a lot of misunderstanding and misperception about the fact that many Native people do have problems with English as a first language, because it is not their first language. It is their second language.
Okay, so what is really illiteracy? If it is not that myth, what do you each find at the library, at the Literacy Council, at Tanana Chiefs Jobs, at ALPA? Who's coming to you or not coming to you? Who has a problem with literacy? Becky?
I see literacy as a continuum, and every person is somewhere on that continuum. Those of us talking together are somewhere on that continuum. The people who come to adult learning programs are from that very stereotypical, narrow focus. That's a very small number of people. The larger number of people are people who just have low-level reading or math skills, writing skills. They've barely written anything that had to do with explaining their own point of view. That's a piece that one would put on the continuum of literacy. They need computer skills, from the very basic computer skills to very sophisticated computer applications that we know change every day. They need a high school credential so they can go on and do further training. They can go to college. They fall into all of those categories.
I like Becky's idea of a continuum, but I like to also think of it not as a kind of low to high continuum necessarily, because everybody has different kinds of skills, and I personally could rate very highly on literacy in English, I'm sure, and I feel confident in that. But I've had the experience of trying to be literate in other languages, and I'm not. I want to be, but I'm not. And so I feel that I, in working with students, all of us can think that that is me in a different context. I would like to be more skilled mechanically. I'm interested in that, but I haven't taken the steps, the hard steps. And I may, in the back of my mind think, well, maybe I could learn that. I'm not totally unmechanical, but I've never taken the steps that one needs to know how to strip down a car engine or something like that. So I'm just not, and sometimes I'm embarrassed by that, because when I go to the mechanic, I would like to be able to not be treated like somebody who doesn't know anything about a car. I'd like to have a little dignity there, and I don't feel I have it, and I would have to do some things to gain respect from the person who is technically literate and who would talk to me as though I were. And so I think that seeing it as a continuum, but a continuum on many different levels, and if you want to use the words low and high, in some continuums, like technical literacy, we may be low in literacy as it has to do with the written word. We may be high in mathematical literacy. We may be somewhere else. And all of us are a combination of all these continuums. So when you look at a student, it's good to look at the whole picture and not just, oh, this person is on the continuum and is down on the continuum. I think that's real important.
Mm-hmm. From a little different perspective, the students, the one thing that I see that links all the students that come to see me who want help with reading or writing or math skills is that they're at a point in their lives where they want to move on, they want to progress, and they feel a little frustrated in where they're at, and they want the help to move on. So whatever that level may be, there's that desire on the individual's part to want to learn more, to be able to improve and move on in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Louise? Well, when some of our clients come to the jobs program for assistance, they make statements like, I feel really dumb, or I'm stupid, this is going to be too difficult for me. I shouldn't even be here. You may not be able to help me. But I always tell them, one of the first things I tell them is that you were referred here. You've gotten a letter from me. You seem to have been able to decipher what was in the letter, and you're sitting here. That is not, that's pretty smart, you know. So let's sit down and really, really look at what your skills are, you know, what your goals are, where you want to go, and how we can help you to get there. So don't think of yourself anymore in those terms. Think of yourself as being smart and wanting to succeed and doing something about it. Be positive.
There is such a stigma in this society about not being able to read and write well. If you're from another country, you're dealing with a lot of issues. If you're an American or Native American, it's being raised in this white society, and you're reading, your English reading and writing skills are not the accepted level. It is so traumatizing that it's even hard to explain. And the students that I see are just carrying this feeling of stupidity and that they're unintelligent when, as Susher said, they could be talented in many other ways. And it is so hard for a student to even come out and say that they need help with reading and writing and math. I have had students come in and sit down, and I'm the first person they've told this to. They've been hiding it their whole lives. Many of our adult readers believe they're the only ones struggling with this problem. It's almost like they're the black sheep. They're kind of not looked at, you know. They're kind of on the side. They're not really acknowledged, these people.
I want to say that it's easier to imagine a physical limitation, a physical handicap, paralysis, blindness, deafness, than a reading limitation. It's much easier. So I think that most people lack sympathy. Like others have said today, they imagine, oh, they didn't try hard enough. Oh, they're stupid. Or some other stereotype.
Someday there'll be robotics that does all the janitorial work. I mean, you can see it coming now. You look at science. You look at the way they're working with mechanical things. They got it in some parts of the country now where they have little robotic vacuum cleaners and stuff come out of the walls. It's the future for the kids are going to be computer programming and desk jobs. And if they don't have an education, they don't have a chance.
Power of knowledge. Knowing things. Know where to find things. Know how to get where you're going. I mean, if you can't read, you can't get from here to Anchorage. You can wind up in the woods, but, you know, you got to be able to read to fly. You got to say, be able to read. The gates say, go down the corridor, turn to your left. If you can't read, you can't do that. People do fake it a lot, but I bet they have a lot of difficulties. So it's better just, and when you go to the grocery store, you know, you got to be able to read, especially now with the health deal. Everybody talking about what you should, don't have cholesterol, have this, do that. I mean, you got to be able to read all that. You can't do that. So, and it's unfair to tell people, you better yourself. I mean, you got to help them to get there, too.
A list of most frequently used words. Years. Where. Much. Way. Come. Since. Against. Go. Always. Away. Something. Fact. President. Side. Social.
By the time he reached sixth grade, Larry had attended 36 schools. He says his mother was always looking for something, so they moved, a lot. And along the way, Larry missed out on or skipped or failed to grasp so many of the fundamentals that in third and fourth grade, and then in fifth and sixth and seventh, a lot of the time he was just lost.
You just get used to the kids and get used to the surroundings a little and to where you can start to feel comfortable. And then you start to pay attention to the class. But every time you get started to study, then you move again. And you go to another school and they have a different system. Or they teach a different way. And some of them, I wasn't there long enough for them to even figure out I couldn't do something. So they didn't have any time to teach me, because I'd be gone again.
It was frustrating. He was bright, but reading and writing and math were like foreign languages. He couldn't read the words or write them down. He couldn't understand the questions, and he couldn't answer them. He played hooky a lot, shined shoes, sold papers, played. When he did go to school, he sat and stared and hung out with kids he describes as being outside of things.
Most of them had reading problems or emotional problems that nobody really paid attention to. I mean, nowadays everybody seems to worry about what's going on in the kid's life in school. You know, they got the system seems to want to try and put the pieces together. When I was a kid, the only thing they cared about is you were there. And if you weren't there, they come knocking on your door. And I don't think they really realize why a person did or didn't go to school, you know? A lot of times, by the time I was in seventh grade, I just didn't care to go. It wasn't doing me any good. Nobody took time to really teach me anything. All they do is yell at me for not doing my lessons. So I'd say, I wasn't taught how to do them, so why should I bother now?
When he quit school, Larry thought all that frustration and pain was behind him. He thought he'd never have to bother with any of it again.
When I got to be an adult, I realized how come the reading was important. I didn't know that as a child, because when you're a child, you don't think about those kind of things. You just don't think about that kind of stuff. I mean, you might think someday you want to be an airplane pilot, but realistically, most kids don't think past the day. You know, go have fun, fishing, do whatever you want.
But as an adult, people treated him differently. He says, like a second-class citizen, or like a kid, or like somebody with mental problems. He couldn't get the kind of jobs he wanted, and he felt increasingly uncomfortable. Life was as frustrating as it was when he was in school.
Fitting in with people, you don't fit in well. As well, you feel self-conscious all the time. Somebody hands you a piece of paper with writing on it, and right away you're just sort of like, what am I going to do with this? So you get to where you get more and more self-conscious. And you get tired, you get tired of trying to pretend. Because if you don't pretend, then people don't understand why you can't read. You should be able to read.
He did what he could, on his own at first. He started bringing first and second grade readers home and picking his way through them. And he started listening carefully to everything, to every conversation, TV or radio show, picking up with his ears what he couldn't decipher with his eyes. And despite himself, he went back to school.
I've been trying off and on to go to schools, at night schools and stuff, since I was about 30. But it's just jobs that I had interfered with my schooling. I couldn't take the time. I had to work instead of going to school sometimes. So a lot of classes, they said if you weren't there every night, then you couldn't come, which to me was restrictive. I had to make a choice between my job and the school. And the job comes first because I had to support myself. I couldn't expect somebody else to support me. So as you get older, it gets harder.
Not too long ago, someone suggested he find a tutor. It would be a one-on-one situation, just him and his teacher. No pressure, no classes, no rigid schedules. Help that wouldn't interfere with his job. And he could read the books he wanted to read. He liked science and history, science fiction, westerns. He went to the Literacy Council and started working with Vicky, his tutor.
When I first started studying here, we went and got books from the library that were adult reading books that are small books, little books, but they were on science fiction. It was something to give your mind that incentive, that anticipation. You get and you start picking it up more and more, and it makes you want to read. It gives you that stimulation. Your mind has to be stimulated, and a child, it's easier to get their curiosity up when they're real little because they don't know any of it. But when you're my age, you know a lot of those things. Go, stop, you know.
He's left the beginning readers behind, Dick and Jane and Sally. He finds he likes the writing of Edgar Rice Burroughs, not the Tarzan series, but other Burroughs books. He likes Louis L'Amour and Isaac Asimov and Jean Aul.
And there's some things I couldn't read when I first read them, mm-hmm. and I'd like to try and read them again. Mm-hmm. But there, I think that's what encourages me to keep trying, because the books that I have read fascinated me. The possibility that it might improve my working ability, I mean, as far as getting a better job, is a good, you know, it's something that I look forward to if I can get good enough. It's just that by the time I get that good, I might be old enough to retire. It's just, I think mostly I just want to be able to enjoy reading the novels, mm-hmm. reading the books. I think that's what encourages me most, mm-hmm. to be able to sit down and read things. Sit down and read the Bible. I've had it read to me twice. It's a fascinating book, mm-hmm. but I can't read it myself. Some of it I can, but some of it I can't. And that, I think that encourages me a little. I want to be able to read something, read it myself, to just be able to sit down and do it.
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day.
Ben Turk stopped beside the door and leaned against the jamb, a cigarette between his lips. A music box was jangling, and somebody in the corner was singing an old sea chanty in a loud, off-key voice. Jean LaBarge walked across the room and took Yankee Sullivan by the shoulder and spun him around. Yankee threw up a hand an instant too late. Jean hit him. The blow was unexpected, and it had been years since anyone had tried to hit him outside a prize ring. He was stunned by that quite as much as by the punch. The man facing him was big, lean, and tough-looking, his black eyes blazing. The blow slammed Sullivan against the bar, and before he could get his hands up, LaBarge knocked him down. In an instant they were surrounded by a milling, shouting mob. Jean drew back and gave Sullivan a chance to get up. It was foolish to give the man any break at all, and he would get none. At that instant there was a pistol shot. Ben Turk had a gun in either hand, and he was smiling. A thin thread of smoke lifted from the left-hand gun. "Let him fight," he said. "If anybody interferes or gets between the fighters and me, I'll kill him."
Word patterns. Short A sounds. Gab. Jab. Lab. Nab. Ack. Pack. Rack. Sack. Add. Bad. Cad. Dad. Pad.
Mary's difficulties with literacy were mostly a product of time and place. She was born in the late 40s in rural Arkansas, where race, politics, and tradition determined what was taught and what was learned. There were strikes against her, but Mary worked hard, got pretty good grades, and graduated high school. She was able to pass state employment tests, first in Arkansas and then in Alaska, and did well enough to find good work.
So I was able to read to a certain extent, but I was just limited, real limited in what I could do. But then where I came from, I think our books and things was behind other kids. So that made it difficult. You learn what you had, but that was not enough. And in the 12th grade, I think it was when they integrated schools in Arkansas. So then we went to the school that was a white school. And they had books that I never heard of, literature, accounting. So where I came from, they didn't have literature and accounting and book reports and all of that. So I think we missed a lot, you know, growing up.
Talking with Mary, you get the sense that she had a good life, even though she'd missed a lot. Work was good and steady. There was family close at hand and a sense of belonging. Not having a strong educational background didn't seem to create the sense of alienation it might for others. What it did do, and what aggravated, was that it shackled her confidence and her potential. It limited what she could know and what she could reach for.
You know, like the newspaper, I could probably read that halfway decent, not really good. But certain books, you know, if you want to go further in life, you was handicapped because you couldn't do anything outside of the little knowledge you had. So then I decided this is not for me. I wanted to do bigger things, so I thought, forget this stuff. So I decided to go to school and get tutoring and all of that so I could do anything I wanted to do.
She was in her mid-30s, picking up after a long absence from a pretty shaky start. But Mary says a new solid grounding in her church gave her the confidence to begin again. A Sunday school teacher there, who also teaches public school, encouraged her to try the Literacy Council. She did, and they gave her a battery of tests to see what her skills levels were, and then books, assignments, and tutors. She began working with tutors 2 evenings a week, spending time at the library and with the teacher who got her started. She says it was the combination that kept her going.
It's like it's all working together. You know, like if I hadn't had a teacher who's motivated to learn, actually that's where it started. A Sunday school teacher that's motivated to learn, then I probably wouldn't have been motivated. But because that person was faithful in telling me, and then I watched her. I mean, she used to spend hours at the library. Hours at the library. I used to go over there and she'd be over there reading and studying. I thought, and if somebody's telling you to do these things and they doing it, you think, well, if they like it, it must be something to this business.
Which is not to say it was easy.
It was a strange thing. My head used to hurt so bad. And I remember my English teacher, writing teacher, told me, she had a lesson one day. She said, you know, when you start to learn, your mind starts stretching. And I thought, oh, this probably was happening to me. But my mind, I mean, it passed. After a while, it just went away. But when I was really struggling and stuff, I used to have terrible headaches. But after I got over that, then everything kind of just started falling in place. So it was hard. I mean, your head hurts. You don't feel like studying. And you got to look up everything just about it. When you go to read the newspaper, you got to look up words. When you pick, like, Newsweek was real difficult. And Newsweek and Time Magazine. So now I can pick up Time Magazine. There are words, some words I don't know, but I can read a lot of them. And I can read articles, just pick up articles and skim them and figure out what it's all about and things like that. So that's really pretty neat.
Mary kept at it, working with Literacy Council tutors at the library. She took classes at Hutchison Career Center and later maintained a B-plus average at Tanana Valley Community College. After a while, she started teaching Bible classes at the church. But before long, she discovered some of her third and fourth graders couldn't read. She took that problem to the Literacy Council, too, to then-director Ricky Sipes. LCA had never worked with kids, but they knew how to train adults to teach others.
What she did is she came and taught us. The church got involved. All the people's here, and taught us how to do reading, to read to kids. So then they brought books to us, and we started having reading classes twice a week. So then we started doing that, and then after that, then I started doing setting up a reading class to continue on to keep doing it. So out of that has grew 2 or 3 years of tutoring kids with reading problems, and we assist in homework now, and we do math and reading.
These days, Mary runs the program. She matches high school students, most of whom are getting straight A's in school, with younger ones who are having problems. Her small battalion of tutors have turned non-readers into readers and helped poor students reach the honor roll. The study class attracts children from the church and, because the word is spreading, from elsewhere in the community.
It's rewarding. So, you know, it's rewarding. I really don't want kids to grow up and have all the difficulties I had. You know, it's easy if they learn it now, and then by the time they get my age, they could be ready to do anything. Mm-hmm. So that's the whole reason I started it. I just started the reading class because I, you know, doesn't matter what whose kids, the nationality of the kids, or the color of the kids. If they need help, they just need help.
Rewarding or not, it's extra work in a busy life. The day we talked with Mary was her day off. We found her in the basement of the church, making sure things would be ready for the students when they came.
So it's more responsibility. It's not glamorous. It's just a need. And I see it's best to try to solve the problem than always tell them, we got a problem. You know what? We got these kids, and they're in this system, and they can't read. We got a problem. Don't nobody ever say, okay, we got a problem, let's solve it. So I decided, if we got it, let's solve it. I mean, we can't solve the whole thing. I can't solve the whole, but I can make a difference in it. So I just decided, okay, I'm not going to sit around blaming the school. I'm not going to blame the parents. I'm just not going to blame anybody. I'm just going to see if we can make a difference.
As the cool stream gushed over one hand, Annie spelled into the other the word water, first slowly, then rapidly. I stood still, my whole attention fixed upon the motion of her fingers. Suddenly I felt a misty consciousness as of something forgotten, a thrill of returning thought, and somehow the mystery of language was revealed to me. I knew then that water meant the wonderful cool something that was flowing over my hand. I left the well house eager to learn. Everything had a name, and each name gave birth to a new thought. As we returned to the house, every object which I touched seemed to quiver with life.
If you learn, you can teach a lot of things, and then plus you learn a lot of things. Then that keep your mind from just becoming stagnant. You know, just walk around talking about the same thing. So dull. So you have to keep feeding your own mind. Then when you feed your own mind, you grow and the people around you grow. Because you're able to draw from a lot of things. When you doesn't read, can't read the paper, some people don't even know what's going on in the world. I mean, a simple reason, they don't read the paper and they don't listen to the news. So you don't know nothing. Only what you see right around you in your little world. But if you read, you could travel to Spain, Italy, Rome, any place, just through a book.
When I wrote the following pages, or rather the bulk of them, I lived alone, in the woods, a mile from my neighbor, in a house which I had built myself, on the shore of Walden Pond, in Concord, Massachusetts, and earned my living by the labor of my hands only. I lived there 2 years and 2 months. At present, I am a sojourner in civilized life again.
Short E sounds. Deck. Heck. Neck. Ent. Dent. Lent. Mess. Bless. Pest.
When we got to the study room at the Literacy Council, Jenny was doing workbook exercises, homonyms, synonyms, and antonyms. They're exercises that help her make sense of concepts and usages for words like weather and weather, bleak or barren, portly and lean. Jenny'd actually finished this workbook once, but she hadn't done well on the tests, so she was beginning at the beginning, the part that had been hardest for her on the exam. She wouldn't be here, starting over, she says, if it weren't for love.
I was married when I was in high school, and I went to school after I got married and tried to get my GED, but I was pregnant during that time and had my son, and it was harder than it wasn't as easy as it was. As it was when I was single and younger. So I regret doing that. You know, I don't advise anybody to pick what they say love over your career or your schooling. If I had a chance to do it all over again, I would finish my school and prepare myself for a career to have a better start at a family, to have a family.
Jenny was born in Puerto Rico. Her father was a Blue Ribbon chef, so the family moved a lot, and by the time they went home again, she was bilingual, a junior in high school, and in the eyes of people there, more American than Puerto Rican. In school, that made things tough.
When I was in the United States, we just only spoke Spanish at home, you know, and my mom taught us what she knew. When I went to Puerto Rico, it was a whole lot different. The vocabulary was different. The way the education was totally different, you know. And then I was using English as a second language instead of a first language. So there was a lot of adjustments to, you know, for myself. My brothers adjusted a lot better because they were younger. I was the one that was mainly affected by it.
One thing led to another. She was married to a young soldier and went with him to Germany, to California and Georgia and New York, and finally Alaska, where the marriage broke up. Jenny found herself with an infant daughter, a growing son, and no skills to support them. She needed help, and she found it through AFDC. Better known as welfare, AFDC connects her to a long bureaucratic chain of funding and perpetual debate that starts in Washington, loops around through Juneau, and for Jenny, her son and daughter, emerges as socks and T-shirts and cornflakes, gas money and coloring books. She's determined that it will be temporary.
I didn't have a GED. I wasn't prepared. So that's the only way I can keep my children with me. It was to get on welfare and go on from there. So now both of my kids are in school. There's no need for me to stay at home and take care of them. During the daytime, I'm there by myself, so I volunteered to the JOBS program to finish my GED.
JOBS is an acronym. It means job opportunities through basic skills, a program long discussed and finally established during the Bush administration. JOBS filters money and guidelines down through channels so people like Jenny can go to school, get training or tutoring, and still buy groceries. The government likes it because it's designed to get people off welfare. That's why Jenny likes it, too.
I would like to have a career and be able to do things for my children and be able to buy things for them instead of being on welfare for a long period of time. It's good that it's there to help people temporarily, but I don't believe that I should be or anyone should be in the program for the rest of their life. I find myself to be more valuable than that. You know, I like to have a career. Right now, my dream is to become a dental hygienist.
First the GED, then college, then a career. But it starts in the LCA study room, where the Literacy Council can provide books and pencils, a tutor, and a place to concentrate. And the Alaska Work Program, JOBS, can provide guidelines and support. But the work is Jenny's, and she says there's nothing easy about it.
It's hard because you're not up to date with the education. You know, as when you drop school and years go by, your reading level goes down, you forget your math, and you forget a lot of things, you know, so you have to go back from scratch from wherever you left off. My vocabulary has to be high enough to understand the medical terms and everything else that goes along with it. If I don't learn that now, I'm going to be lost when I get there. I might not be able to get in there because I have to take a test and be accepted to the university before I do anything else.
She comes to the study room every day after she drops her son and daughter off at school. Most days she works until it's time to pick them up again. She says they keep her going.
I guess that's what mainly gives me the determination, you know. I don't like during the month when my kids need something and I'm not able to give it to them because there's not enough money. Or when I run out of money, maybe gas money or groceries or something, you know. When I grew up, my parents gave me everything that I needed. And I feel like I'm cheating my own children that way.
John Steinbeck wrote this. Some people there are who, being grown, forget the horrible task of learning to read. It is perhaps the greatest single effort that a human undertakes, and he must do it as a child.
An adult is rarely successful in the undertaking, the reduction of experience to a set of symbols. For 1,000,000 years these humans have existed, and they have only learned this trick, this magic, in the final 10,000 of the 1,000,000.
I do not know how usual my experience is, but I have seen in my children the appalled agony of trying to learn to read. They, at least, have my experience. I remember that words, written or printed, were devils, and books, because they gave me pain, were my enemies.
Some literature was in the air around me. The Bible I absorbed through my skin. My uncles exuded Shakespeare, and Pilgrim's Progress was mixed with my mother's milk. But these things came into my ears. They were sounds, rhythms, figures. Books were printed demons, the tongs and thumbscrews of outrageous persecution.
And then one day, an aunt gave me a book and fatuously ignored my resentment. I stared at the black print with hatred. And then, gradually, the pages opened and let me in. The magic happened. The Bible and Shakespeare and Pilgrim's Progress belonged to everyone. But this was mine.
Take a piece of paper, and when somebody hands you a joke or something that's wrote down, and you look at it, and then you sort of, you know, act like you read it, and yeah, and you let it go. Or you just act like you weren't interested. You know, just anything to avoid talking about any kind of reading. If you went places where you didn't have to worry about being confronted with paper, you know. Anything to do with words on paper, you just went to different areas. You didn't go places where people would be talking about books or pushing books at you or...
The Fish and the Pup. This is Dan Oliver. Dan has a shop. His shop is at the river. This is Kim Hill. Kim is in the shop. Dan sells her a fish. Kim puts the fish in her tent. The tent is at the river. This is Queen. Queen is Dan's pup. The pup is in the tent. Queen looks at the fish. Queen picks up the fish. Queen runs to the river. Kim looks at the pup. Kim yells, "Dan, the pup has the fish!" Kim yells, "Get the fish!" Dan runs to the river. Dan yells at the pup. The pup runs to Dan. The pup gives the fish to him. Dan gives the fish to Kim.
Short I sounds. Kick. Lick. Gift. Big. Kill. Mill.
I was never encouraged to go further than high school. I was always told that high school is something that they demand you do by law, and therefore I have to finish it. Nobody had mentioned that I could be anything I wanted to be.
There were troubles at home. Mike didn't get along with his dad. He didn't feel at home there. And there were troubles at school. No connection. No feeling of belonging or purpose. Around eighth grade, Mike just opted out. He started skipping classes, drinking and doing drugs, and making trouble. People told him later all that trouble was his way of making the world pay attention, shaking it so it would see him, see that things were anything but okay.
I mean, I couldn't say that in my house, so I went out around the neighborhood and around the whole North Pole area and told them in that way, you know, by getting in trouble. And I guess it was a way to let them know how I was feeling.
But it was a long time between creating problems and figuring out why he was doing it. He was in trouble at school repeatedly, junior high, high school, the alternative school. He was arrested and spent time in McLaughlin, the youth facility in Anchorage. Another arrest, another stint at McLaughlin. Between the two, his folks kicked him out. At one point, Mike made an attempt, 2 years of cooking school, so he'd have a trade. But there was a lot of drinking then, too, and between the time he was 20 and 28, Mike spent over 3 years in jail for one thing and another.
I really had myself believing that I had a good philosophy of life, that we were just ants in a big colony and just a number, and that what we did during life was not going to matter one way or another. You know, I had no real grasp of our culture, our society. I was not a part of it. I was just a fifth wheel. And I also believe that people who hurt people deserve to be hurt. So I got in a lot of fights, and in my mind, they were all justified. It was real self-defeating. I resented my parents. I resented this society for the Fairbanks, and I resented my culture, my native culture. I resented everybody.
All this time, the same Mike who was always in trouble was aware that he was very bright. He says he talked a lot about turning his life around. He made promises to other people and to himself as well. But they say you don't change until you're ready. Stop drinking or straighten up or lose weight or whatever the promise is. Mike says it took him a really long time. But when he was ready, life gave him the help he needed.
It was really funny the way it happened. It didn't happen in the usual sense, like start going to AA meetings every day. But what happened was when I met Stephanie, she had given me an ultimatum to quit drinking or quit coming around, and she wasn't really forceful about it. I mean, I still lived here and had a beer every now and then.
But there were fewer and fewer of them, and a couple of months later, Mike realized he wasn't drinking at all, so he might as well stop altogether. Around that time, Stephanie, who was a part-time student at UAF, asked Mike if he wanted to come along, go back to school. He was willing, but wary.
I knew I was really good with numbers. I didn't know how far that would get you in math. I mean, in ninth grade, they expect you to understand elementary algebra, and that word algebra is what kind of shied me off. And English, I thought college was going to be a lot like high school, where it's really confined to a real tight structure. And that since I didn't understand, I still don't really understand what prepositional phrases, you know, and pronouns and stuff like that are. And I thought that if you didn't understand that, you couldn't really go to college. So, and since I was skipping since the eighth grade, I didn't have a very good grasp on that stuff.
But he had his GED, and he had a new attitude and support. Mike started taking classes, at first working his way through developmental math and English at Tanana Valley campus, and last year he started at the U. He also started working off a community service sentence by tutoring other math students through the Literacy Council. Mike now tutors there, at the jail, and at the university.
I just started in eighth grade math last year, last January, and I remember a lot of the battles that I had to overcome in order to pass, you know, to get to where I am right now. You know, I'm starting my third semester of calculus. You know, I try to set up examples of why you're doing certain things. You know, people just start crunching numbers and they're going, God, why am I doing this? I mean, is this really going to help me when I get out into the world? And nobody really believes that. Although there is so much potential for what you learn in math to help you out in the everyday world. And I try to let people see that while I'm tutoring them.
Mike's hoping to graduate UAF in the spring of 96 and then law school. When he was a child, his dream was to be a lawyer someday. He says he lost that dream along the way, but now he's found it. Whatever happens, he says he won't lose his way again. He calls himself a survivalist.
I believe a true survivalist is somebody who doesn't carry around weapons everywhere they go and padlock all their doors and windows. A survivalist is somebody who is perfectly adapted to their environment. And also a survivalist is somebody who tries to pave the way for their children to have the best chance of survival in that society. And I know that in this culture, your parents are blamed for a lot of the kids' problems. So I was already giving my kids a handicap by getting in so much trouble as an adult. And whenever my kids get in trouble, it would say, oh, well, no wonder. Look at his parents. Look at their father. I don't even have any kids of my own yet, but when I do, I want them to have somebody who was able to, I mean, a father who was able to survive and live in this culture and to give my children the best possibility of survival in this environment. And that's what I decided to become. And after that, I really started to excel because I wanted to not only complete school, I wanted to do well and learn a lot.
Should you ask me whence these stories, whence these legends and traditions, with the odors of the forests, with the dew and damp of meadows, with the curling smoke of wigwams, with the rushing of great rivers, with their frequent repetitions and their wild reverberations as of thunder in the mountains, I should answer, I should tell you, from the forests and the prairies, from the great lakes of the Northland, from the land of the Ojibwas, from the land of the Dakotas, from the mountains, moors, and fenlands where the heron and shushuga feeds among the reeds and rushes. I repeat them as I heard them from the lips of Nawadaha, the musician, the sweet singer. Should you ask where Nawadaha found these songs so wild and wayward, found these legends and traditions, I should answer, I should tell you, in the bird's nest of the forest, in the lodges of the beaver, in the hoof prints of the bison, in the ire of the eagle.
Kids, you know, if their parents read, then they read. And also it's important if the parents read to the kids. And most kids' parents don't read. No, I shouldn't say most. A percentage of parents does not read to their kids. So they don't, you know. And then kids become the environment. You know, if you're in a certain environment, that's where you become, unless you read and change your way of thinking. And a lot of times that don't happen. A lot of times the parents can't read that good. And it's not that easy to pick up a book and go to reading when you can't read good. It's real difficult.
Little Boy Blue. Little Boy Blue, come blow your horn. The cows in the meadow, the sheep's in the corn. But where is the little boy tending the sheep? He's under the haystack, fast asleep. Will you wake him? No, not I. For if I do, he's sure to cry.
What each of the people said tells me that learning to read as a 30-year-old or a 40-year-old or learning English as a second language as a 50-year-old is entirely different than gaining literacy skills as a child. Mm-hmm. Is from a tutor's point of view, mm-hmm. Is that so?
Yeah.
How is that so?
I think it is true. I think part of it is because as we get older, you know, as little kids, we're real open to things. And as we get older, we build blocks and we kind of build resistance to things. And one of the things that adult learners do is one of the walls that they build or one of the beliefs that they build is that they're not capable of learning or that they're stupid, even though the fact that they don't have the literacy skills has nothing at all to do with their intelligence. It's simply that they didn't have the opportunities to learn as kids. So often, an adult learner believes, part of his belief system is that he is stupid and he can't learn. And one of the biggest, that's a real big wall to knock down. So in learning,
that belief system has to change. And what usually happens is as an adult learns and they make small steps and they make progress little by little, they start to realize, oh yeah, I can do this. And the more they realize that they can do it, the more they learn, the more they're able to take in and learn. But it's a real big wall to knock down, is the belief that you can't do it. I think that's one of the biggest obstacles for adults, and that ties in with the whole stigma in society that adult non-readers are not intelligent human beings. So our adult new readers are carrying that stigma with them.
How easy or hard is it to make those small steps that mark progress significant if reading is this vast locked box? Then are the first steps to reading often dismissed by the adult learner? If I was really reading successfully, I'd be reading Hemingway, okay, not See Dick Run.
Yeah, I think that does connect in. I think there is, I had one student who surrounded himself with books. He just surrounded, and he couldn't read them, but he'd pick them up and he'd try, because he knew he wanted so badly to be able to read them. And I think there is a frustration that comes when you see this, all these books around you, and you can't pick them up and you can't read them, and the only thing you can read are perhaps books written at lower levels or for children, or just a word here or there in the newspaper.
Is it very important then to create incremental steps, or are all learners different? Maybe this is the question. Are learners very different as adults than, say, we think of children as a mass of learning energy?
All learners are very different, very different. What we find with adult learners, for some adult learners, they've also figured out ways to kind of get around words and to get around reading because they're very intelligent. So for example, they'll only read the words that they know, and they won't even try to read the other words, and they never have tried to read the other words, and that's all they know how to do. So it's just a pattern that they've created for themselves, and each learner has their own patterns that they've created to get around their difficulty in reading. And it's real hard sometimes, the tutor and the student, it takes a while to figure out, well, what is this pattern that I've created that's blocking me from being able to look at this word and be able to read it? So I do think each student is distinctly different. That's one of the problems with some of the books written for adult learners. Some are applicable to some people and some are not at all. And often we just have to create our own lesson plans and our own lessons, because each individual has created their own walls or blocks or ways of learning that often make it difficult to learn to read easily as an adult.
How long does it take?
That's a good question. And I think it's real. Again, it's very individual. If we look at our own schooling, we tend to be, as adults, we're really impatient with ourselves. You know, we think, well, if I go to school for a month or so, you know, I'll really improve my skills. But just think of when we went to school, and we went from one grade to another after about 9 months of schooling, a year. We say in this tutoring field that it takes approximately 40 hours of one-to-one tutoring, with the student working quite a bit on their own to see a significant to see a student move up to another level. But I would say rarely do adults have the opportunity to devote an enormous amount of time to studying, because they're usually working and taking care of their families and doing 100 other things at the same time. So often it stretches out over a year or 2 years to even to see someone move up to another level. But again, it's real individualized. It depends how much energy that individual and time that individual has to put into learning and studying. And it can be very, very frustrating because what's involved is a lot of patience.
Is there a breakthrough point for adult learners where it comes together? I can get it now?
I think just like when we're learning a lot of other skills, you kind of climb the hill and then you plateau for a while. Sometimes you might have to dip down into the valley a little bit, and then you come back up again and you go a little higher up a higher hill. You know, it's a bit like that. It's just like learning anything else. But when something clicks in, it's such a beautiful moment, you know, because you just see the light for a moment, you know. And usually when there are moments where ideas or concepts or whatever the student's working with will suddenly click in, and those clicks tend to continue. They don't usually disappear. And those clicks usually feed a lot more clicks because they give the student the confidence. They go, yeah, I got this. I can keep going. I can make more clicks. Yeah. So again, it depends on the individual, but there are these, usually the progress, actually I would say it's not a real steep mountain, especially at first. It's more like a low hill, you know, and then you'll go down to the moments where you'll forget, you know, and go down into the valley. But little by little, it just takes a lot of patience.
Susan Knabel trains and supervises tutors for the Literacy Council in Fairbanks. As this program was being prepared, Education Secretary Richard Riley released a survey on American literacy. The results, he said, show that over 90 million American adults have such poor literacy skills they're not able to keep up with a world that's becoming more and more complex. For this program, thanks to the people of the Literacy Council for Alaska, Nolwenn Library, the Adult Learning Programs of Alaska, and Tanana Chiefs Conference, thanks to the students, and thanks as well to Robert Hannon, Greg Ruff, Dana Hart, and Joy Morrison for lending their voices. For KUAC-FM, for Conversations, I'm Susan McGinnis.